Welcome to Acid Horizon, the Theory Podcast. Today is a special episode. We are in the Dome talking to Jack Bagby of the California Institute of Integral Studies. And today our topic is this, Matter and Memory, probably Bergson's most famous book. And we're going to talk about Bergson's theory of perception and the theory of image that he puts forward. Jack, welcome to the Dome.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your interest in Bergson. How is it that you got into the work of Bergson, and why do you think it's important for us perhaps to return to his work?
Yeah, I got into Bergson in grad school through Deleuze and Merleau-Ponty. His work was mentioned in them. It seemed adjacent to them. And as I got into Matter and Memory, which was the first book I read of his, I was immediately hooked, kind of changed the path of my writing in grad school, ended up writing on Bergson. And he's a figure who is gaining popularity right now, primarily through the work of Deleuze, and now sort of on his own as well. But he was massively popular at the time and massively influential as well. He had this sort of debate with Einstein. He supposedly started the first traffic jam in New York City because of one of his talks. So there's a massive interest in his work that died out around the 1940s. He died in 1941 and wasn't revived until the 60s. And I think a lot of people now are seeing connection with so many other thinkers adjacent to him.
I'd like to start by talking about Bergson's theory of the image. The very first time that I started reading Deleuze, I mean, I'd heard of Bergson before, but Deleuze had mentioned something to the effect in one of his pieces of writing that Bergson believes that everything is an image. Now, if you delve deeply into chapter one of Matter and Memory, Bergson talks about the fact that, well, for him, conceptually, not only are the objects of perception images, but it's also the case that that which comprehends them or senses them is an image, the spinal cord, the brain. Now, this seems to defy a general intuition about what an image is. How does Bergson use this concept of the image, and how does it ground his theory of perception?
Yeah, so the image is a starting point for Bergson within Matter and Memory to reapproach the psychophysical relationship, we could say, and by that, reality. And so the image is everything in one sense, but it's not as if all reality is reducible to the image, because the image for Bergson is a movement in the process of actualizing itself. And there is another sort of half to reality, we could say, which is the virtual, which is primarily understood through memory. So matter and memory. Matter, he understands through images. The image is a movement, and the image is the entire universe. And he has this famous diagram of the cone and the plane, and he wants to understand our contact with sensation and perception as intimately connected with reality. We're not separated from reality in a Kantian sense or in a empiricist sense. So, you know, our phenomenal reality is a kind of illusion for the empiricist, epiphenomenon. And then for the Kantian, everything that we experience is a phenomenon, but we don't have access to the thing in itself. So Bergson is trying to escape from this paradigm. He says that the image is more than a representation. So it's not something that we just create in our mind, but it's also less than a thing in the sense of a thing out there separate from us that we have a phenomenal experience of, but not any contact with. So it really closes this gap created in metaphysics.
Right. He starts with this presupposition. I mean, you could almost call it the famous third term that he brings in to collapse the distinction between matter and memory. Before we get on to talking about common sense in Bergson's work, let's talk about the concept of memory, because he has this sort of interesting concept where memory is this kind of flow within which images arise and kind of get cut out and representations are formed. And actually, Bergson makes a distinction between an image and a representation. So how are we to parse these terms?
Yes, exactly. So he's a realist when it comes to memory, I think we could say, or a realist when it comes to the past. He thinks that the past exists, that it has reality independent of our memory of it, independent of our ability to access it through recollections or anything like that. Everything that's ever happened exists in some way. It doesn't have it doesn't have to be stored in anything. So this is the big problem he has with theories of memory at the time, that memories are stored within the brain. He thinks that the brain plays an important role in us accessing memories, but that they aren't stored in the brain. And so the past in its being, Deleuze imports these terms onto Bergson to some degree, that the present is becoming and the past is being in this metaphysical, classical sense. And the past exists virtually. It doesn't have an image, we could say, versus the becoming that we experience in the present. And that's what he's calling an image. Now, a representation would be something like a tangent or a derivative in the mathematical sense. So you have a curve and you have tangents that touch it at a certain one point, but don't actually describe the curve movement at all. So our duration, our experience of time can be sliced up into what he would call derivatives or snapshots. It wouldn't be a reality. It would be a kind of extraction from the reality of images, which are becoming.
Now, Bergson seems to have a really rigorous knowledge and engagement with science. But some of the stuff you're talking about right now sounds really spooky. The idea that memory goes beyond the brain. I mean, how is this received by other quote unquote materialists of the time?
Well, it was not received by them. Well, you have people like Russell, for instance, who reject it. But I actually just recently gave a presentation on Ernst Mach and Bergson. And Mach is this kind of like anti-metaphysician. But he ends up giving an account that is extremely close to Bergson's. And actually, William James introduced them. And Bergson said, Mach and I came to the same ideas, especially about images, from completely different approaches. So there was an osmosis between science and Bergson's philosophy. We can also think here of like the unconscious in Freud. There's a lot of overlaps here. And now there's people working on, you know, the virtual within science, and Leibniz is the one who kind of first characterized the idea of the virtual. And he was certainly not opposed to science. Bergson also in Time and Free Will, in Matter and Memory, is drawing on all of these scientific studies of his day and maladies coming about within the brain with respect to memory.
Now, as a good Deleuzian, I shouldn't be using common sense as my starting point to invent new concepts. Oh, I mean, maybe I could, but ordinarily I probably wouldn't. But in Bergson's work, especially in chapter one of Matter and Memory, clearly he's going for a notion of common sense as grounding his theory of perception. How is he doing that? And how might this differ from Deleuze's understanding of how to use or incorporate common sense in a theoretical construct?
Yeah, so he uses common sense in a positive manner, insofar as in common sense, we haven't made this split metaphysically between the immanent and the transcendent, we could say. The, empiricist, as I already mentioned, says that what I'm experiencing is secondary qualities. Whitehead, for instance, calls this the bifurcation of nature, that my secondary qualities are somehow epiphenomenon or lesser realities than the underlying mechanisms. And on the other hand, the neo-Kantians want to say that there's some reality that remains always outside of our grasp, and all we have is this phenomenal reality, which we construct with our consciousness. And so Bergson's appeal to common sense is to get us outside of those metaphysical presuppositions. But on the other hand, he's also against common sense in a way very similar to Deleuze, in that common sense wants to say that everything is a snapshot, basically, that we can look at representations and we can look at the world as a sort of collecting of facts, and that all of these facts are present to consciousness and actual, and that everything I experience can be made into a clear and distinct idea, this kind of Cartesian common sense. And Bergson is radically shifting that to say reality extends beyond what consciousness can make a representation of, both in the image and in relation to the past.
Maybe we'll dig into the distinction between image and representation a little bit more, because it seems the way that Bergson construes the idea of representation, that it's like a cutout from this flow, the flow of memory,
exactly,
perhaps, or it's what we see when this sort of flow of memory or perception encounters a kind of obstacle of sorts and ossifies or desiccates upon a particular constrained image. And I don't want to overlap those terms too much, but how is it that Bergson actually thinks about representation?
Yeah. So, I mean, representation would be a very small subset of reality instead of the way that the Kantian, like all reality is a kind of representation within consciousness. It's actually a very small subset and a diminution, he uses this phrase often, or subtraction. We have this complex, qualitatively rich becoming, which is the image. And it's infinitely detailed. And we can shift our perspective on it, pulling out certain details, suppressing other details. This is consciousness expanding and contracting itself with respect to the image. And our experience of the image is always going to be primed, you could say, by culture, by our past, by how we're feeling that day, things like that, and retains within itself a richer content than our consciousness is ever able to extract from it. So representation is always going to be this very diminished, less rich, almost a sketch of what within concrete experience we're open to.
You know, while I was reading Bergson, it made me recall this line from the archetypal psychologist James Hillman, where he said that consciousness, in a sense, is one of, or ego consciousness, is one of the least conscious facets of our perception, in the sense that beyond what is delimited by what we normally understand by consciousness, there's a whole plethora of drives or activity going on. And this is an idea that seems to correspond a little bit with what Bergson is talking about. Maybe you could talk about what Bergson believes about consciousness with respect to this broader flow of memory.
Yeah. So yeah, consciousness is arising from the interaction of our memory and our body in its becoming. So the image. The image, like I should also say that the image for Bergson, first and foremost, is our own body. That's the image that we immediately experience and that is always there, you could say. And it is a interrelationship with the entire universe. So this is where Deleuze, like plane of immanence and all of this is going to come in for Bergson, that my body is immediately what it is because of its relationship with the entire rest of the universe in a becoming. But my consciousness of that image, my body image, is a relation between my memory and that shifting becoming. And consciousness is what emerges when these two realities come in contact with each other. And actually, consciousness is a diminution or a subtraction of these two realities. So our past involves an infinite number of details and memories, everything that's ever happened to us. And even right now, just this room that I'm in, there's too many details for me to take them all in, but they're all part of my past and the infinite detail of my memory, right? This, what he calls the integral or pure past, is a past with an infinity of details. And then there's a pure image, an infinite idea of the image, where it's an infinitely rich and detailed, inexhaustibly rich with details. And between these two, there's repression. So our memories repress the detail of our experience in order to keep us, you know, on track with practical needs. If I'm noticing the grain in the wood, I'm not going to be able to work with it as a carpenter as well. And reverse side, our perceptions are limiting our memories. If all of my memories were coming in at any point in time, again, I wouldn't be able to stick with what I'm doing at the present. So repression, and this is a Freudian notion, obviously, as well, is essential to consciousness. Consciousness is the double repression, basically, of the integral image or the infinitely complex image in its becoming and the pure past with its endless details.
So I suppose the next question I have is about the body in the image's body. Mm-hmm. And perhaps one of the critiques or problems that may come out of Bergson's thought is these escalating orders of perceptual hierarchy, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that he seems to say is that as our consciousness or our awareness is able to circumscribe more and more sense data or details about reality, there's a certain underlying ethical implication, which is, well, that creates a greater kind of being. And one of the things that I think about quite a bit, especially with relation to phenomenology, is, you know, like disability theory. In your encounter with Bergson, or even in your own engagement with Bergson, what do you think are some of the ethical upshots of this? And do you think that Bergson's thought, maybe not only Bergson himself, but phenomenology broadly construed, is challenged by some of like disability theorists?
I certainly do. And maybe I can unpack a bit about how we get there and then answer that. So, Bergson is an early gestalt, we could say, view of physiology and psychology, meaning that instead of seeing atomic parts being put together in an abstract kind of information processing system, everything is a globally organized whole, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts and is orchestrated in time, these kind of ideas. So our perceptual system is in dialogue and is an open system with respect to its environment. You know, we have all these images in gestalt psychology where the duck, rabbit, or whatever, and we're having a gestalt shift in our perception. This idea of gestalt shift in perception is essential for Bergson. Like, we have the propensity to alter the way that we perceive the world. And this is essential for things like invention and bringing about novelty and creating a new future. Elia Al-Saji is a scholar working in this area. She has an amazing article called The Ethics of Hesitation. And it's all about shifting the way that we perceive. In this particular context, it's about like racialized perception and being able to interrupt the habits of perception. So this is saying that perception isn't just this accepting of data into our, you know, organs, but that it's always shaped by a cultural, historical set of interpretive structures. And phenomenology, you know, Merleau-Ponty, and then this aspect of Bergson offer us a way of understanding this, you could say the moral dimension of attention, that there's a way of shifting our attention, and that hesitating being creating an interval between sensation and reaction. Racialized perception, for instance, is already set up to respond to a stimuli in a certain way. She looks at like the headdresses in France, which caused an uproar and this kind of thing. And like, how can we actually use a shift in gestalt of perception to interrupt these racializing perceptions?
You know, a favorite topic here on our show is dreams and fantasies and the imagination. So what does Bergson believe about dreams in the realm of fantasy? Because recently I've been working with Bachelard's work. Mm-hmm. I've looked at Jung and Hillman and so forth. And often he's a big contender in these debates. Yeah. What does Bergson believe about dreams, and how might his view challenge other notions of the dream?
Yeah, well, there's a beautiful line in Matter of Memory about this where he talks about the man of action and the man of dreams. And he opposes these to each other. And the man of action is remains tightly bound to the world and what can be done and how what we're experiencing can immediately lead to some action, right? And the man of dreams is completely detached and just things are flowing in. And he understands this in relation to matter and memory, right? So the more freed you are from the habitual response of your attunement to the world and your controlling of what's happening within matter, extracting value, he uses these kind of terms like extracting value from the present situation. The man of action is always alert to extract as much advantage as possible from reality. And the dream state is completely detached. And this he actually thinks is essential to doing metaphysics and doing philosophy. You know, he has a positive sense of metaphysics in a similar way to Deleuze, like a lot of people of his time. But only through this relaxation of our attention can consciousness be transformed into a new form of consciousness. And, you know, he uses this term intuition. And Deleuze doesn't really use this term, but has the same idea that we need new ways of thinking. We need to actually like invent a new type of mind and a new type of intelligence. And the dream reality, the imaginal, all of this is essential to this for Bergson. I mean, I think in the end, what he wants is a sort of balance between these. He wants there to be the detachment. He talks about, for instance, like Beethoven in this way. You know, Beethoven's symphonies are the most intricate and like you could analyze them forever. But where do they come from? They come from this release from all analysis and all sort of detail orientedness to get a dreamlike expansive vision of the piece as a whole that leads to its composition.
One of the things that really impressed me about reading Matter and Memory this time around was noticing how Bergson, basically it's a methodological point. He theorizes a totality of images. Mm-hmm. He theorizes what we could call, I guess, like a pure flow of memory. Mm-hmm. And all of this then accrues to an understanding of, you know, the real, raw, material, perceptual apparatus. I mean, this is something that scientists today would probably be really challenged in licensing themselves to think this way about perception. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could just talk a little bit about Bergson's overall methodology, and how might, for example, thinking Bergsonianly mm-hmm. be relevant to today's cognitive studies, for example?
Yeah. So Bergson says metaphysics is the science that dispenses with symbols. And we don't need to get stuck on this word metaphysics and what that exactly means, but he wants to completely change the way we approach studying consciousness and perception. So we'll say that that's metaphysics for now, even though that's not what people normally mean by that term. But so dispensing with symbols is actually, again, very similar to what Ernst Mach was trying to do. He says the physicist is obsessed with atoms. And we see this in psychology too. Like the empiricist psychologists of his time and the neo-Kantian ones wanted to see sense perception as made up by atoms and then information processing. And this model is first of all, totally unfounded. There's no scientific experiment that tells us that that's the way that we should look at it. It's just a very coherent way of thinking, derived, again, from our discourse with reality, with materiality, where we try to extract advantage from it. It's a really good way of extracting advantage from reality, but it's not necessarily the way that things are structured on a deeper level. And this was the big move in Gestalt psychology. And we see it actually rippling in a way through science. It happens within quantum mechanics. It even happens at the level of self-organizing systems in biology. All of these were a way of dispensing with the symbols that were used to make sense of the world. And they're, again, useful symbols, but they don't really get their claws in to reality.
Now, everybody at home who's listening should know that I actually met Jack in a bar in Bullsburg, which is really the best place to meet a philosopher. And despite the fact that we both live in Pennsylvania, he teaches in California and through some sort of Bergsonian trick. Anyway, Jack, could you just please tell us about your current research interests and where they could find your work?
Yeah, so I have worked a lot on Bergson. I have several articles. One that just came out on Bergson and calculus. So I kind of mentioned a bit of that already in the journal Process Studies. I sort of made a shift in my research over the last maybe 2 or 3 years towards philosophy of music, which is a big area I'm working in now. And I'm a musician as well as you are. So we're going to hopefully be playing some music. Yeah. So philosophy of music, phenomenology of music. Those are areas that I'm going to be having a lot more articles and hopefully a book coming in the future.
And I know you have a YouTube channel too. Mm-hmm. Socratic Swan Song.
Correct.
Right?
Exactly.
So I'll link that in the show notes and I'll link anything else that you send me afterwards. It was a pleasure having you on today.
It was great. So fun. Thanks.